the tension that many Black parents are navigating is this idea that you want to communicate to them the very real conditions that have created a world that might see them as dangerous, that might fear them, but you also don't want to overwhelm your child with the sense that this is somehow their fault.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum via Zoom. I'm Mary Stack, the director of Cambridge Forum, and today we're very delighted to welcome as our guest, writer, poet, and educator, Clint Smith. More than 7 million people have watched Clint's two TED Talks, The Danger of Silence and How to Raise a Black Son in America. His poetry collection, Counting Descent, has received awards and critical acclaim, and his new book, How the Word is Passed, which examines our relationship with slavery, is due out next year. He currently resides in Maryland with his wife and two children, and in addition to writing, teaches at the DC Central Detention Facility. Professor Jude Nixon, who is acting as our moderator today, was born and educated in Granada and came to university in America in 1984. A post-civil rights intellectual, Jude was often the only Black man teaching in his university department. However, he and his wife successfully raised their two sons and a daughter, and they lived in three different parts of the country, Pennsylvania, Texas, and Michigan. Throughout this entire career, Jude kept a constant journal during the 80s and 90s, noting the things that worked for him as a Black father raising his children. It was entitled Living While Black. A warm welcome to both of you. Let me start by asking you, Clint, to explain to us why you felt the need to present your TED Talk, and also why you wrote the article in the June Atlantic, Becoming a Parent in the Age of Black Life Matters.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. It's fascinating. You know, my TED Talk was written in 2015. At that point, I didn't have any children. And so I was sort of operating in the imaginative space. I was sort of thinking about, I was seeing everything happening. This was after Michael Brown and Eric Garner and so many others. And we were sort of in what felt like the crescendo of the movement for Black lives. And it was getting more and more attention. It was getting more and more vibrant and robust in terms of the sort of how many people were sort of becoming politicized to recognize and achieving some level of sort of consciousness with regard to how the police and the state in various iterations treat its Black citizens. And so I was operating largely in the sort of imaginative space and the space of possibility and the sort of wondering what are the kind of things that I would tell my children if I were to have them. And but thinking about the sort of intergenerational nature of the talk and the conversations that my father had had with me and that his father had had with him. And to what extent is this talk a sort of heirloom that is passed down through Black families about finding that balance between communicating to your child the realities of the world while at the same time not making them feel as if they have done something to deserve it, as if there is something inherent to them that makes them worthy of or deserving of this treatment. And I think that that's the tension that many Black parents and teachers of Black children and people who deal and spend time with Black children and Black youth are navigating. It's this idea that you want to communicate to them the very real conditions that have created a world that might see them as dangerous, that might fear them, that might treat them differently before they ever have a sense of who they are based on what they look like. But you also don't want to overwhelm your child with the sense that this is somehow their fault. And, you know, so in June of 2020, I wrote a piece for The Atlantic, kind of on the other side of this. I have a 3-year-old son and a 1-year-old daughter, and we are obviously in the midst of global pandemic and quarantine. And I was thinking about how being a father to two young children, two young Black children, in the midst of a global pandemic that is disproportionately killing Black people in this country and Latinx people in this country. And thinking about the, you know, my home as the home of many parents across this country has turned into a 24/7 daycare in ways that we did not necessarily anticipate. And so my wife and I both work full time and we both split childcare duty. And for me, we go, you know, when I'm on duty, part of what we love to do is go on these long walks. And there's a park with a big empty field about a mile from our house, and we walk to the park. When we get there, we run around the open field, we blow dandelions, we play, pretend that we're wizards, and we pick up sticks and try to turn each other into farm animals. We play tag. We do all of the things that, you know, parents do with their young children, in the way that our children sort of bring the youth out of us in ways that we hadn't experienced in a long time. And, you know, many people think of me as a pretty serious person, but when I'm with my kids, I'm a dragon. I am a little piggy. I am, you know, a little piggy holding a tea party, all of the things. And so I'm thinking a lot about, and have been thinking a lot about, how my children serve as a sort of respite from so much of what was happening with the pandemic, and with the you know, this was following the death of George Floyd, so many others, in what felt like quick succession, Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery. How my children were this respite from all that was going on in the world, because, as you know, when I'm with them, I try to be fully present. I'm not sort of endlessly scrolling through my timeline or looking at the news or reading the news or watching the news. And so I'm not overwhelmed by the nature of what's happening in the world. But they are also at the same time this constant reminder of how urgent the work is to build something better than what we have now, and that the stakes are so much higher because of my young children. And I look around the world and I see what's happening, and I say that this can't be the world that my kids grow up in. We have to make and create something better than this. And so there is that sort of that complicated duality as well, where my kids both provide me as a sort of with a respite from all that's going on, but are also this ongoing, ever-present reminder that this work is more urgent for me than it has ever been.
You're listening to Cambridge Forum as we continue our discussion of Parenting While Black with poet, writer, and educator Clint Smith and Professor Jude Nixon from Salem State University.
Clint, welcome. Jude, so can you tell me a little bit about what it's like with teaching and writing and literature at the DC Central Detention Facility, and what it's like working with these often young men, incarcerated students? And I think it's Mother Teresa who talked about it in the sense of doing small things with great love. Mm. What has it been like in this incremental changes that you're trying to make in this facility?
Yeah, I appreciate that question. So, you know, I was a high school English teacher before I went to graduate school. And so I worked with 15, 16, 17, 18 year olds. And in DC jail, I'm working with young men who are the same age or just a couple years older than so many of the students who I worked with. And these are young men. This is a jail, so a lot of them are awaiting trial. This is a group of young men, many of whom are facing like decades and decades and decades in prison. And just consistently, it is young men who were born into circumstances that and communities that have been systemically plundered, that have been systemically under-resourced, that have been decimated of opportunities for upward mobility. And it is not an accident that that is the pipeline of young men who continue to become entangled in the criminal legal system. So I think what also has become very clear to me is that what we need is to create a more robust social infrastructure that sort of breaks that pipeline down and makes it so that people, that these young men are coming from communities that have the resources they need so that they don't fall into the set of circumstances or become entangled themselves or adjacent to the circumstances that would lead them to be involved in, to become incarcerated at some point in the first place.
And some years ago, when I was back in Michigan at the university, I was moderating a debate between Michael Eric Dyson and his wife. And Michael said, interestingly, during the debate, he said, Black families in America are sort of split in the sense of, there's often a successful Black man and a brother who's in jail or dead. Mm. In many ways, the Baldwin short story, Sonny's Blues, which again talks about the math teacher brother and Sonny himself who has to maneuver between drugs and incarceration. And again, illustrating in fact what Mike talked about. Mike said, and I'm reading, he said, meet my brother Everett. A few weeks back, like so many other families across America, I took the day to go to visit my relatives in prison. Living with a relative who's incarcerated adds an additional fiscal, emotional, and mental burden onto families who are often already struggling. Lateral violence born out of economic injustice and systemic racism means that many, too many of the families being impacted are Black and Brown. Our elected officials inform our systems of criminal justice, of health, and of education. This is why we need to work to elect individuals who have the welfare of our children and our community in mind. The task, I think, that Mike is talking about, that Baldwin is talking about, and you are talking about and working in, is certainly vast. How do you imagine that institutionally we can expand or accelerate these programs, and how might it be successful?
Yeah, so I currently, it's an important question. I currently, and have, you know, for the last several years, have done a lot of work in prison education. And I think what is incredibly important is ensuring that people who are incarcerated have access to robust, legitimate, meaningful educational opportunities, from the basic education to the GRE, to high school diplomas, to bachelor's, to master's, to doctoral opportunities. I think that is incredibly, incredibly important. The goal is not to have more robust education systems in prison and to continue to have as many people in prison as there are, right? The goal is that we're not putting so many people in prison in the first place. The goal is to move towards the obsolescence of prisons in the first place, and to decrease the power of the carceral state. And so I always want to be really clear with folks. I'm a teacher in prisons, I'm a prison educator, and it is so, so important to me that the millions of people who are currently in jail and in prison have access to good medical care, have access to good educational opportunities. But making those things better cannot and should not legitimate the sort of larger carceral institution. What it is a recognition that we need to attend to the needs of people who are currently incarcerated while building the sort of robust social infrastructure outside of prison, making sure that people have access to housing, making sure that people have access to jobs, and not only just jobs, but jobs that pay them a living wage, make sure that people have access to healthcare, mental health services, so that people can navigate the trauma that they're experiencing in their communities. And so if you create the sort of social bedrock upon which people can build meaningful, happy, prosperous lives, then you fundamentally decrease the need for prisons in the first place, because people are not becoming entangled in the circumstances that would lead to involvement with the criminal legal system more broadly. So I think it is really important. You know, I work with an organization right now called Free Minds DC, and we bring books both to, you know, we teach in DC jail. But the leaders of Free Minds DC, we just had an event last night. They'll be the first to tell you, like, what we want is to make it so that an organization like Free Minds DC doesn't have to exist. Like, what we want is to build the sort of world in which these organizations inside of prison become increasingly unnecessary and irrelevant, because we have cut off the pipeline of people coming into prison because we've given them the things that they need beforehand.
As Mary mentioned earlier, I have three children, much, much older than yours. So I have gone through those tough early years. When they were much younger, we lived in Texas. I taught at Baylor. And we moved from Texas to Michigan. And Jackie shared something with me. She said, "I'm delighted that we moved to Michigan." And I couldn't figure out. I thought I was really disappointing the kids, moving them in the middle of their school year. And Jackie said, "I was completely aware of the pernicious, silent, and debilitating racism that my daughter Jackie had been a victim of in Texas." Mm. So I asked her why, and she said, "Dad, she never used the word because I was Black." She said, "Dad, when I was in Texas, I wanted to be a cheerleader and I couldn't." Mm. She said, "I wanted to be the head of the environmental club and I couldn't. I wanted to be in charge of the French club and I couldn't. I wanted to be the editor in chief of the school newspaper and I couldn't." She said, "Now in Michigan, I am all of that." Mm. And so I wonder, as you think of this experience, how is it that children can internalize and silently deal with the questions of race in a society without often articulating it?
Mm. No, that's, yeah, I'm really glad you shared that. And I'm so sorry for, her, but I think it is also consistent with what a lot of young Black children experience in different ways, you know? So for me, I grew up in New Orleans, Louisiana, my whole life, and until Hurricane Katrina, which was my senior year of high school. And then I finished school in Houston, Texas. When I was in New Orleans, I sort of navigated a range of different demographic worlds. I went to public school my whole life and grew up in a Black community, but I also played soccer my whole life and largely played soccer with a bunch of kids, white kids from the suburbs. And it was interesting moving between those spaces because something that would happen, I'll always remember this moment when I think I was 13 years old, and there had been a police shooting in New Orleans. And this was before the era of camera phones. This was before the era of smartphones and social media, so that it didn't spread in the same way that it did now. This was also a point at which like police accounts of events were taken at face value rather than being interrogated in the way that they are now, because we have a lot more transparency around via the camera phones and whatnot around how police records of incidents are not necessarily consistent with what the camera is showing us. And so I remember one of the kids on my soccer team said, people were protesting out in the community and trying to get justice for the young man who was shot. And one of the kids on my soccer team said, like, Clint, I don't know why Black people are always getting upset when people are shot by police, but like never doing anything when Black people are killed by other Black people, which happens all the time, right? Like, what about all this Black on Black crime? Mm-hmm. Which is a refrain that, you know, Black people have heard for decades and decades and decades. And obviously this is a, 12-year-old boy. So he's largely parroting what he has probably heard his parents say. He's parroting what he's probably heard on the news and in the media. And I remember being 12 years old and feeling so angry and feeling so confused and feeling a sense of paralysis, because I knew that what he was saying was wrong, but I didn't know how to say it. And I didn't have the history. I didn't have the sociology. I didn't have the toolkit with which to push back against so much of what was being thrown at me, right? And so much of what of the message, not only from him, but from the larger sort of public discourse around Black life at that point, that's sought to delegitimize our concerns about state-sanctioned violence because of intra-community violence that was happening. And so, I wasn't able to speak to the fact that like people in Black communities have deeply robust anti-violence initiatives, from the church to the school to the YMCA to the local basketball league. I mean, the myriad of ways that Black people attempt to mitigate intra-community violence is vast and robust. And so saying that Black people don't care about the crime happening in their community simply reflects the fact that you don't spend much time in Black communities. I didn't have the language to talk about the history of hyper-segregation in this country that has made it so that Black people, as a result of housing segregation and redlining, weren't able to buy homes in other neighborhoods, thus saturating poverty and violence in specific communities. And any social scientist will tell you that when you saturate people in certain communities and lock them in to these communities, then you're going to create scenarios of desperation. You're going to create scenarios that lead to potential violence. But even more broadly than that, because of the history of segregation in this country, Black people tend to live near other Black people. White people tend to live near other white people. Latinx people tend to live near other Latinx people, and it goes on and on. And people commit crime against those who they live in close proximity to. So it is not, per the last statistics I saw via the FBI, 84% of white people are killed by other white people, but no one goes around saying, well, what about white on white crime? Like, why are all these white people killing all these other white people? Because people who live in proximity to one another commit crimes against one another, and that exists across racial lines. But again, I'm 12 years old and I don't have the language to say that. I don't have the language to talk about the history of housing segregation. So I think part of what animates the work that I do now is trying to help give young people the tools in a scaffolded, age-appropriate way, the tools to better understand that the world is a social construction and thus can be reconstructed and deconstructed and made into something new, and that the conditions of your community is not an inevitability. It is the result of decisions that have been made. It's the result of policy that have been made. It's the result of things that have been taken from your community and given to other communities. And I think it's important for Black children to understand that, because when I began to learn those things, it was like a deeply liberating thing. It was like profoundly emancipatory, because I finally had the language and the toolkit with which to understand that so much of what this country had told me for so long was a lie, that it wasn't true. Right, and that the reason one part of New Orleans looks one way, another part of New Orleans looks another way, and one part of DC looks one way, another part of DC looks another way, and one part of Philly looks one way, another part of Philly looks another way, it's not because of the people in those communities, but it's because of what has been done to those communities generation after generation after generation. And I think it's so important to communicate that to young people, both Black and white, because otherwise all of them grow up with a sense that what they see around them is the result of the people who live in those conditions rather than the things that have been done to those people to create those conditions.
To say nothing of the public message that Black lives don't matter, and that Black lives can easily be taken away. And so there's a kind of buying in of the Black community into that public messages, whether it's deliberate or subliminal. So there's a lot of ways in which we don't value Black lives because of the messaging that happens in the public through television, media, commercials, what have you. So that's another thing that's hard to confront. Tell me about your forthcoming book, first nonfiction book, How the Word is Passed, which examines how different historical sites reckon with or fail to reckon with their relationship with slavery. Why is this such an important topic to you, and what is your solution to dealing with place names and other physical reminders of these villains from our past?
Yeah, it's fascinating to be writing a book about historical sites and monuments and memorials and museums in this moment, because I was joking with my wife, I was like, you kind of look around and you're like, oh, that's chapter 4 over there. You know, like, oh, that's chapter 7 happening in Virginia. And that's chapter. So there is a reckoning that is happening. And I hope that my book will be able to contribute to the discourse around how this country and the different places that have specific relationships to the history of slavery reckon with that history. So some of the places that I go are Monticello Plantation in Virginia, to think about how does an institution like Monticello hold and communicate to their visitors that Thomas Jefferson was the person who drafted the Declaration of Independence, and that he is also someone who wrote in Notes to the State of Virginia that Black people are inherently inferior to white people, both in endowments of body and mind, and alluded to the fact that the slave might be incapable of love, or incapable of sustaining complex emotion, writes about Phyllis Wheatley, considered to be the first published African-American poet, female poet in the history of the United States. He's like, well, I don't know that Black people have the intellectual or artistic capacity with which to create art. So we can call this something else, but we shouldn't call it poetry, because it is, quote, beneath the dignity of criticism. It's not worthy of even engaging with in that way. How do you as an institution communicate that Jefferson was a brilliant man, which he was, and also that he enslaved over 600 people? Yeah. How do you communicate that he was the intellectual founding father of this country in some ways, and also that he enslaved 4 of his own children, right? Like, what does it mean to hold those truths at once, and how do you as a space communicate that history to people? I go to Angola Prison in Louisiana. Angola is the largest maximum security prison in the country. Between 70 and 80% of the people incarcerated there are Black men, and it sits on top of a former plantation. If we were to go to Germany and you had the largest maximum security prison in Germany on top of a former concentration camp, and 70 to 80% of its current occupants were Jewish, it would be a global emblem of anti-Semitism. It would be so unforgivable. It would be so repugnant to our moral sensibilities. No one would accept it, and they shouldn't. People would be protesting outside of it every day. Yeah. And yet in the United States, 70 to 80% of the people in this prison, the biggest maximum security prison in the country, 18,000 acres, the size of Manhattan, is on top of a former plantation, multiple plantations. And it is not even that it is not known. It's almost the first thing that's written about Angola in every piece that's written about it. But there's something about white supremacy that both enacts violence and also numbs us to certain types of violences that should otherwise be wildly unacceptable. And so, you know, I also go to the Blandford Cemetery, which is the largest Confederate cemetery in the country, and think about how the myth of the lost cause perpetuates itself, and think about these monuments. You know, I grew up in New Orleans, and on my way to school every day, I passed a statue of Confederate General PGT Beauregard. On my way to the grocery store, I drove down Robert E. Lee Boulevard. On my way to the dry cleaners, we went down Jefferson Davis Highway. There are over 100 schools, street names, and buildings in New Orleans named after former Confederate soldiers or people who owned enslaved people. So my childhood was saturated with the iconography of the Confederacy and the iconography of white people who owned human beings in a majority Black city. And I think about, what are the sort of symbolic implications of that? What does it mean for like me as a young Black child to, when I go into City Park, like the biggest park in our town, to drive past a statue of a man who fought a war that was predicated on maintaining and expanding the institution of slavery? It feels so, you know, and luckily, you know, I think we're in the moment now where more and more people are beginning to, like, it's becoming clear to people. This should have always been clear. It was clear to Black people from, you know, long before these statues were ever put up, that it is absurd, notwithstanding that they lost the war, notwithstanding that they were traitors to their country, but that they fought the war, the traitorous war, with the intention of maintaining and expanding human bondage over millions of people. There is no way that those people should ever be lifted up on a pedestal in a public space in implicit or explicit reverence in that way. I mean, it's just the Confederate statues are like the low-hanging fruit of all of this, I think, right? Whereas it's so clear that they should not exist and that they should be taken down, and, you know, you can put them in a museum, you can go put them all together in a field, a lost cause field somewhere, but they should not be funded by taxpayer dollars. They should not be maintained by taxpayer dollars. They should not be in public parks, in front of courthouses, and in public spaces as they are now. And so, you know, when the statues came down in 2017 in New Orleans, that was largely the sort of catalyst for this book, because I was thinking about all the places in New Orleans. You know, you drive around the French Quarter, and that daiquiri shop used to be a slave pen, and that hotel used to be where auctions were held, and that parking lot used to be where people were taken out into public and flogged, you know. And it was, but there were very few, and there are very few markers of those places. And so I became increasingly interested with the sort of confluence of thinking about both the iconography of the Confederacy and all of the places in my own city growing up that had ties, you know, to the history of enslavement that I wasn't fully aware of. And I wanted to travel across the country and think about how different places were reckoning or failing to reckon with that in the way that my city was.
That history is an important part of the Southern past. I recall when I was at Baylor, there was hardly a morning over faculty coffee that the war of Northern aggression didn't come up. Mm-hmm. And that's not too long ago. So right. It's very much an alive part of the Southern history. It's not just monuments. It's how those monuments are sort of animate everyday conversation and animate everyday life.
Absolutely.
So I'd like to thank you both, poet, writer, and educator Clint Smith and Professor Jude Nixon from Salem State University. We're supported by the Lowell Institute, the Mass Cultural Council, and today's program was underwritten by a special grant from Cambridge Trust Bank. And I want to thank everyone who joined us and everyone who will enjoy this program on the podcast via our website, cambridgeforum.org. I'll see you all soon.
Thank you.